podcast where we talk to people from the world of audio about their ideas, opinions, and methods.
Hi, I'm Mark Young. For this episode, I spoke with the Canadian producer and DJ, Noah Pred. He had been scheduled to speak at this year's Ableton Loop Festival, which has now unfortunately been postponed till next year. However, his topic of keeping the creative flow going while in the studio seemed more relevant than ever to these times of lockdown and quarantine. In the podcast, we talk about his early transition to electronic music, how he ended up becoming a music educator, and his tips how to keep those creative juices flowing. Noah Pred is next. Noah, thanks very much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're a producer and a DJ, but also a music educator. We're recording this podcast just before your class at the BIM Music School here in Berlin. What exactly will you be teaching your students today?
Today, we're going to be looking at some Max for Live stuff. You know, I never set out to become an instructor. It sort of happened by accident. When I was living in Toronto, word sort of got out that I was quite knowledgeable about Ableton Live in particular at the time. And people just started, you know, requesting, you know, calling me for help or, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? And eventually it just sort of organically snowballed into a thing where a friend of mine who was running a music equipment shop in Toronto, Moog Audio, not affiliated with Moog Music, offered me the chance to do a workshop there. And I was quite hesitant at first. I was reluctant, but, you know, the request kept coming in. And finally I said, you know what? Screw it. I'll give it a shot.
Might as well make some money if people are asking for your help.
And it sort of snowballed from there. And I ended up, I've been working closely with Ableton, since around that time. And moving to Berlin, it's been a great thing as an immigrant in a foreign country to have this opportunity to work with young artists and also, you know, keep myself afloat a little bit. It's been really rewarding. But so, yeah, today's class in particular is a little bit of drum synthesis and then some Max for Live stuff.
Okay. And how about your own musical education? Because, I mean, that sounded very organic, how you became a teacher yourself. But what about your own education? You're now a successful producer and sound designer. But where did you start out growing up in Canada, as you just mentioned?
Well, you know, fairly typical piano lessons as a youngster. First piano recital I can remember playing the theme to the Pink Panther.
Okay.
And my brother is a very talented, accomplished bass player. So I switched tack to guitar and bass at a pretty young age and started playing in bands.
How old were you?
13, okay. I would say. And I was mostly playing bass, but a friend of mine had a Tascam 4-track recorder that he wasn't really using, and he loaned it to me. And my brother had passed on his TR-505, terrible old Roland drum machine, although I still have the fondness for the hi-hats on that thing. And I'd somehow acquired a realistic Moog, which I wish I'd kept my hands on, at a garage sale. This is like early 90s. Nobody really knew what was going on at the time or what price they might have fetched for it if they had hung on to it. And so every day coming home from school, I was just recording. I would record like two or three new songs every day on the 4-track. It was just that age where just bursting with ideas, I guess. But, you know, aside from those early music lessons, no formal training. I never went to, you know, an audio engineering school or anything like that. Pretty much self-taught.
And when you say you're recording two or three tracks, that was like with your buddy doing one thing, or were you doing everything?
I was doing everything. So okay. I was programming the drums, right. I was playing bass, guitar, doing some, you know, rudimentary howling that might...
I was going to ask, like, what kind of flavor, can you give us what kind of genre area were you...
I would say at the time it was kind of experimental, psychedelic, indie rock, but some funk weirdness in there. I mean, that's the thing. When you're doing two or three tracks every day and you're basically just making them for yourself, the whole point is to experiment and try different things, right? So unfortunately, all those recordings were thrown out at some point when I was living away, and they were just in an unlabeled box, and they're unfortunately lost to the ages. But sometimes I think about how fun it would be to hear them again.
to pull back. To kind of see where you started out, where you've come. Because when I was preparing for this interview, then I was reading that you eventually segued and you started doing DJ sets with vinyl records. But before that, you were doing more electronic music live, though. Is that a fair description? Or does that mean,
Yeah, absolutely. So mid-90s, I went to, you know, the biggest sort of city near where I was growing up at the time, Victoria, British Columbia, with a couple guys I was in a band with. And we went to a Mudhoney concert. So I was actually growing up on an island and the ferry stopped running at 9:30 p.m. So there were no ferries left when the show ended. And somehow we didn't plan for this, but I met somebody at the show who said they were going to a rave after. And I was curious because I had recently read an article in Spin magazine about this nascent rave culture. Yeah, exactly. And so I thought, well, you know, this could be an interesting way to spend the night. And so, as I mentioned, my brother, talented bassist, had always sort of instilled in me a certain fondness for classic funk and soul records. But at the time, early 90s, you know, grunge was sort of the dominant sound, particularly in the Pacific Northwest.
I was just going to say, Mudhoney up there. Yeah,
Mudhoney, exactly. And that was kind of the sludgy psychedelic rock I was playing with the bands I was in at the time. But then arriving that night at this underground rave party and hearing house music for the first time, it immediately clicked. And I was like, I could see that that's where the lineage of that funk and soul music had sort of bubbled through to, from disco into this kind of, like, at least in North America at the time, not very publicized path. And so a light bulb went off and I saw somebody DJing for the first time and I thought, so wait a second, I don't have to compromise with band members. I could just make my own music. And so from that point on, I started saving money and eventually bought a couple synthesizers and started doing this live PA sort of thing where I was mixing between a groove box and a workstation. And it was very, again, this is the thing about being self-taught, is sometimes you do things in a very strange way when you're starting out. So it's funny to look back on, but it worked and I was playing shows and stuff. But, I actually started, you know, getting booked and flying around to perform. But, I remember in particular, I had a Yamaha sampler and the RAM chip kept getting knocked out in the flight case. Ooh. And it was such a headache to travel with the equipment that eventually I thought, you know what, I'm going to try this DJing thing and really took to it, found that I really enjoyed it. Not only did I enjoy the process of mixing records once I got the hang of it, but it's also so much fun to share other people's music that you really love, you know? And that's basically the trajectory from, live PA, as they called it at the time, to DJing.
And I guess because the electronic music these days is such a digital affair. I mean, we're talking about vinyl, which is again, organic or an analog, but as far as the production side of it, because you're not just a DJ, you're a producer as well. And it's such a digital affair these days, but originally it was like tape machines and oscillators. And that's where I wanted to kind of touch with you, is if you started out maybe more in an analog world or approach, how do you see it today? I mean, are you, I guess, what was the last piece of music? Is that Soft Science? Is that the last thing you just put out?
The release on Trauma on there in December. Yeah.
I just want to kind of to see, where are you these days? Is it primarily or exclusively a digital process now when you're making your own music? Or are you still bringing in those analog elements, or whether hardware, whatever it might be?
So it's an interesting combination of the two. So I've got a studio with a fair bit of analog hardware, which I love working with, and the tactile nature of changing the sounds in real time and obviously the sound itself is so sumptuous. But it's being triggered often by some custom sequencers that I've built myself in Max MSP. So the origins in some ways are digital, like a lot of the core musical frameworks are generated digitally, triggering the analog instruments, recorded back through my UAD, and then processed digitally again. So it's interesting to think that the origin and the final stage, it's kind of an analog sandwich, I guess you could say.
Okay,
it's a good way to put it. Digital bread on either side,
that's right.
But the real meat is all analog.
Analog,
so.
Okay.
Yeah,
that sounds like a healthy meal. That's I know we were talking briefly before this interview as well that many, many years ago you did an entire album with field recordings. You said you're from British Columbia and you were out getting these organic sounds. I mean, how is it that you're bringing maybe you can just tell us a little bit about that. I mean, because again, I know that it was quite a ways back, but just the idea of making an entire album, maybe producing it digitally, but the origin of every single sound was analog and from the natural world, right?
Yeah. So for 1 year, I was living in an area just north of Vancouver called the Sunshine Coast, which was misnamed, I think, by real estate agents trying to sell property there because it is very rainy, but beautiful rainforest. And so there's a festival in Vancouver called New Forms, which is still going. And yeah, so that project was born out of doing an audiovisual performance where all the sounds were going to be constructed from field recordings collected in the rainforest of that area. Mount Elphinstone is the actual name.
Oh, wow.
Of the the slopes on which those rainforests have grown. And and a friend of mine, the visual collaborator, was also going to take all the visual source material from photos in the area, but in both cases deeply transformed to the point of, you know, being more or less unrecognizable. So the challenge was, you know, I still wanted it to retain some organic texture, but the point wasn't for it to sound like birds chirping and babbling brooks and, you know, banging on sticks. So then it became a matter of how do I take these source sounds and shorten the oscillations so I can tune it and play something musically, or how do I process it enough to make it, you know, compelling as a, for the genre.
That's kind of where I was going with that question when you were out there in that rainforest, were you field recording with specific musical sound, like sounds, elements in mind, or was it, you know, like you're hunting for something that could work as a kick or a snare or a hi-hat sound, and it happens to be whatever it is, a woodpecker or, you know, or was it more the process of going out and getting these sounds, harvesting them, and then when you're in the studio, tucked away, then you're then turning it into what you're saying? How did it work?
To the best of my recollection, because this is
a long time.
Yeah. This is a long time ago. This is almost 20 years ago. Wow. It was a bit of both. So you know, when I needed something with a sharp transient, you know, maybe I was finding some rocks or something to bang together. But then aside from that, there was definitely, let's see what I got and see what I can do with it. So yeah, a bit of both. And so that album got released on a label that my friend Adam Marshall runs called New Canada. And I recently re-released it as a benefit for an organization based in British Columbia called RAVEN, which stands for Respecting Aboriginal Values and Environmental Needs. And so they are basically funding legal defenses from First Nations organizations who are kind of the last line of defense in trying to prevent the sort of environmentally destructive resource extraction that a lot of the big mining, logging, and oil corporations make all their profit from.
That's where I saw it. That's where I discovered it. So let's give them a proper plug. People can find it on your Bandcamp.
Yeah, that's on Bandcamp, and all the proceeds go to RAVEN. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So be sure to check that out. And as you said, that was quite a while ago. Are you still using field recording in your process these days?
It's funny that you wanted to bring this up because, you know, here and there, yes, but
it's
not...
microphone company, so we're bringing up field recording.
Yeah, not as an area of particular focus. However, I do have a project I'm working on that will involve collecting more field recordings this summer. So I'm looking forward to that.
Do you have any particular advice for somebody who would maybe be interested in integrating field recording into their production process? Do you have any... Because like you said it was... It was a bit of both of hunting for specific sounds or kind of, you know, processing them after the fact. Do you have any kind of advice for somebody who might be interested in starting to bring that into their creative process?
You know, I think listening is a big part of it. Listen while you're out and find places with unique sounds that you might want to go back and record. I think, yeah, that's one half of the battle. And the other half is maybe just being prepared to capture interesting things when they happen.
And just kind of going with it.
Yeah.
That's a great segue, going with the flow, because you're about to have a workshop at the Loop Festival here in Berlin on Studio Flow. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. What exactly are you going to be imparting there?
Well, I've been doing some research lately. You know, there's quite a popular book by a psychologist and researcher named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Maybe not. He wrote a book called Flows, New York Times bestseller, all this kind of thing. But where he was engaged in this area of research about peak performers across all disciplines and these sort of intrinsically motivating states that keep them coming back for more, and kind of identifying those states as existing in this optimal balance between appropriate challenge for the person's current skill level and skills that are commensurate to the challenge that they're taking on. So if they're engaged in whatever, could be basketball or chess or whatever it is, if their opponent is not challenging enough, they get bored, it's too easy, it's not really, it's hard for them to access these flow states, as they're called. Or on the other hand, if their skills aren't great enough and the challenge is too intense, then they get frustrated. So how do you find that sort of optimal zone? And so I've been looking at a bunch of different techniques for this, some of them practical, strategic, and some of them a little more philosophical. And yeah, basically, you know, particularly nowadays, so many people are engaged in producing music, and a lot of us maybe don't have quite as much time to do that as we want, you know, with all the hustle and grind nowadays. So given that that studio time is limited, how can we make the most of it? And so, yeah, looking at techniques and strategies for that.
Just yesterday, I saw something pop up that someone has created a Pomodoro timer for Ableton Live, that it's an actual plugin that you can plop it into it. And if for those people who aren't familiar with the Pomodoro thing, the idea is breaking your day down into like whatever half an hour chunks and actually putting yourself under those in this sense, I guess it's a little unexpected that even in something where you're creating music, you're trying to be creative, that you would put yourself under that time constraint. But I just thought it was a funny coincidence that we were about to talk and that someone is even making plugins.
I'll have to look into that. That's definitely one technique I've looked at and sometimes bring up, as you know, we're also distracted by social media, and that Pomodoro technique is a great way of putting your mind at ease, knowing that you're gonna be able to check your social media in 30 minutes. But you have to put it off until then.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one technique. And another thing that I think is useful, you know, is trying to help get the ego out of the way. We all talk about this, but how do you actually do that? And one way to take the pressure off a bit is to zoom out and kind of realize that, you know, we put all this pressure on ourselves as individual creators, right? But I think it's useful to actually recontextualize our creative moment as part of a much larger process, a much greater flow of creativity, when you consider, you know, you didn't probably program the software you're using. You certainly didn't build the computer.
Right.
You didn't invent right. the scales, you know, that are being used or any of the techniques for that matter. You're really just kind of the tip of the spear, right? And so once you can kind of allow yourself to be subsumed in this flow that depending how far you want to zoom out really goes back millennia, then you can take this pressure off yourself and be a little more in the moment. And the, you know, the other main thing too is again, you look at, again, with the athletic metaphor, for example, you got to get warmed up first, right? And so a lot of people tend to put a lot of pressure on their first idea. And so criticality is obviously important to the creative process, but there's a time and a place for it. And if you you let that critical voice dominate from the start, it's hard to get anywhere. So you got to get warmed up first and let those ideas, first ideas flow out. Doesn't matter how bad they are. Many of us have to get 5, 10, 20 bad ideas out before the good ones can arrive.
Shake them out.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah. It's just like getting warmed up,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But if you don't even let yourself get warmed up and you try and force that first idea
yeah.
to become good, you know, there are a few sayings about this. But,
okay. Yeah. No, that's good. That's definitely, you can definitely see that. I think it's a good metaphor of the idea of just shaking it out. I know I do it myself of something similar for writing as well. You just gotta start writing, and it's not going to be great. You gotta edit after the fact, you know. But you've been nominated twice for Canada's prestigious Juno Award. Do you feel you have a particularly Canadian way of making music, or you've been almost a decade, I believe, right here in Berlin, right? Or do you feel that you now have a decidedly more Teutonic approach to electronic music?
Huh. That's interesting. I've never quite considered that. I'd like to think by now I've developed my own voice with a variety of influences. But, you know, music is such a global phenomenon now. I think maybe when I was starting out, scenes were much more localized in that it was still dial-up internet and you couldn't just kind of, you know, stream what's going on across the world. And I think there is still a lot of this locality in certain networks that, maybe. And you know, people are still reliant on their communities, immediate communities, for feedback and all this kind of thing. And I think that's really important. And Berlin's a city that's famous for having a specific sound, especially with regards to techno. But I just think we're living in an era now where I don't know if those localized sounds even make sense. And to talk about a Canadian sound, I mean, Canada's a big country too. I mean, there's a Toronto sound, Montreal sound, or once upon a time there was. But less so now. I think maybe it's a more about susceptibility to the environment around you more so than necessarily taking on the character of a place.
How would you describe your sound now?
Oh.
I know it's easy just to splice together genres these days, you know, or it's maybe, I don't know if it's easy, but it's kind of a lot of genre crossing or blending going on. But I mean, if somebody asks you, what do you tell them?
I mean, I've got all kinds of different irons in the fire right now and different sort of projects. And over the winter, I did some studio sessions where I was really trying to take a different approach with every session. So it varies, but like the last records I released, I would say, we're more in a techno vein, but trying to retain very organic qualities. A lot of techno coming out of Berlin. You know, it's funny, actually, going back to the previous question, do I have, you know, the techno strongly associated with the city right now is and emulated by many worldwide is fairly cold and cavernous, which is not a sound I've ever particularly related to. And in fact, strive to avoid in terms of retaining some semblance of soulfulness and, just organic texture and a little warmth on the low end, I guess. But I'm doing a lot of electro stuff at higher BPMs and trying to sort of shift my focus into doing some interactive installation-based work as well.
As you said, Berlin has had this kind of dominant, whether it's tech house or minimal tech house, but a lot of the new influences in electronic music are coming more from the so-called global south, you know, a lot of different, I guess maybe getting away more from the 4/4 beats. So it's interesting to hear that you, as you called yourself an immigrant to Berlin, that you, when you came here, it wasn't that you were adherent to the Berlin sound, so to speak, but it was big enough. It's a big enough community here that you still found your place here, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that's fair to say. Yeah. I'm very excited for these influences, as you say, coming from not just the Northern Hemisphere, not just Eurocentric culture. And I think especially the influence of polyrhythms is overdue, and I'm excited for it.
Cool. So you've got Loop coming up, and what's next after that? You mentioned some field recording. What else do you have in store for 2020?
I'm planning some tour dates at the moment and a few other projects that are top secret, under wraps. Okay. Can't really divulge too much at this point.
Okay. Be sure to tell us, and maybe we can add it to the bottom of the podcast, and we'll definitely link to those tour dates as well.
Okay. Great.
Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, Tim. Thanks for having me.
That was Noah Pred, and this has been Signal Path. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast for more stories from the people shaping the world of audio. Thanks very much for listening. Hope you tune in again next time.